Astonishing Legends Network.
Welcome back, everybody, and welcome to this special bonus episode, Weirdumentary. Okay, so I grew up in Los Angeles in the 1970s, and depending on the city where you grew up, if you grew up in the 70s watching television, you probably have extremely specific memories of the commercials you would see during daytime television. Like in Los Angeles, we had commercials for Cal Worthington, a used car dealer. And the thing, it was always Cal Worthington and his dog, Spot. But then his dog was always like a longhorn steer or a Bengal tiger or some other unexpected animal. And he'd be rolling around with it in front of aisles and aisles of used cars. And you're basically waiting for this animal to tear his head off. And you're a kid and you're watching this stuff and you think this is all part of normal adult life. What else? There was this clothing store called Zachary All that featured the most boring man in the world trying to sell you suits. I remember a furniture store called Lee's Bars, Stools, and Dinettes. Not bar stools and dinettes. Bars, stools, and dinettes. There was something called Control Data Institute that I guess was like a computer school. And there was a grainy film of people feeding punch cards into enormous room-sized computers with those weird giant reel-to-reel discs that started and stopped and moved in weird rhythms. And there was the Bryman School, which is all about learning to work in a doctor's world, whatever that meant. And there were tons of others, but you know, you'd see them 75 times a day while you're sitting there watching reruns of Get Smart and Twilight Zone and I Dream of Jeannie. And these things, they're just lodged in my head. I'm going to be spitting this stuff out 5 minutes after I'm dead. But okay, the commercials that really stuck out, the ones that really got us excited, were the commercials for any time there was a new movie from Sun Classic Pictures. Because that meant there was going to be a movie about people that looked like scientists, and they'd all be talking about the Bermuda Triangle, or some upcoming UFO invasion, or Bigfoot, or the discovery of Noah's Ark on Mount Ararat. By the way, how would I ever know the name of a mountain in Turkey if it wasn't for In Search of Noah's Ark? Thank you, Sun Classic Pictures. And for some reason, these movies were always being held over in Inyo and Kern counties, and I didn't know where those places were or why these movies were being held over in those places. But in Los Angeles, you would always hear on the commercial that these movies, The Mysterious Monsters or The Outer Space Connection, at the very end, it would always say, held over in Inyo and Kern counties, which, as it turns out, are two actual counties in California. Anyway, these movies like Beyond and Back, which was about near-death experiences, or The Man Who Saw Tomorrow, which, of course, was about Nostradamus. These were the classics, and the granddaddy of them all, of course, was Chariots of the Gods. And then movies like this led to TV shows that were very much in that same style, like Leonard Nimoy's In Search Of, and then years later, things like Unsolved Mysteries. So these things had a huge impact on the culture. They clearly had a huge impact on me. I thought I was the only person in the world who remembered these movies. But then a few months ago, my lifelong friend, Michael Grodner, gave me a book for my birthday called Weirdumentary, which is basically this gorgeous paperback coffee table book devoted to these movies. And it's just, it's gorgeous. And it's so fun to read. You guys, this is the kind of book you're going to love. And today on the show, I get to talk to the author, Gary D. Rhodes. Gary's a film historian. He's an author. And he writes about movies. He's written, deeply on vampire movies and Bela Lugosi specifically. But he's written about Todd Browning, who did Freaks, and Ed Wood, who did Plan 9 from Outer Space, and you know the rest. Anyway, just great stuff. And he's a great guy, really fun. So today our conversation is all about those weird umentaries. So grab some stale milk duds and a flat, overly sweet Dr. Pepper and settle into your threadbare theater seat with sticky armrests and get ready for the show. Here we go. Gary Rhodes, welcome to Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. I'm so happy to have you here.
Wonderful to be here with you. Thanks so much for asking me to join you.
So I received the book Weird Umentary for my birthday from a friend of mine who has the magical ability to always find something that A, I don't know about, and B, I absolutely love. And this was no different.
Great. Well, I'm glad, I'm glad people are still buying and reading books. as a writer, that's something we're more scared of, as you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, here at Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf.
Right. You've got to have books.
You have to have the books.
Otherwise, it's an empty shelf.
Exactly. Well, right. That's what's so great about the listeners to this show. All they want to talk about in our Facebook group, all we talk about are books and cats.
Wonderful.
And ghosts sometimes,
Sure.
But no, they love books. And this, I feel like there are very few books I don't see coming or I don't know about. And this one came out of left field. So even though I've already explained it, I'm sure in the introduction to the show, how would you describe a weird umentary? What's the definition?
Well, thanks for that. I suppose, like so many writers, we love to invent a new word. Or I guess if you want to be, academic or academic-y, gimmicky, neologism, really, I suppose, is taking, two different existing words. So that's the word I concocted for what I believed, I still believe, is a kind of a unique era in filmmaking that really comes on in the late 60s. There's earlier kind of proto weird umentaries, I think, but basically we're talking 69, 70 through about the early 80s. This was a period of certainly documentaries, pseudoscience documentaries on everything from Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster, ghosts, UFOs, ancient astronauts so famously. The Chariots of the Gods really kicks it off, I think, Von Daniken and for me, the film adaptation documentary. And it kind of ends with Orson Welles' Nostradamus documentary that was released by Warner Brothers. And that's one part, I think, of what the weird documentary is many of the films I'm talking about had theatrical releases. Many of them actually did quite well at the box office, particularly, in terms of budget versus return. And, it was this wonderful era. Some of us were young at the time, but I think even for some older audience members, these were enigmatic topics. This was a period, of inquiry where, hey, maybe this really is real. Maybe there is something to, whatever, hunting Bigfoot or hearing spirit raps, etc. I think for me, the other things about the documentaries that were kind of consistent is it seemed that they always wanted to have an on-camera host. And usually that meant somebody who was associated with strange subjects, weird subjects, Rod Serling, William Shatner, who's still doing these, literally, these kinds of TV programs to the present day.
That's right.
Orson Welles, John Carradine, people who had various kind of associations with things that were strange or weird. Welles, obviously, with the War of the Worlds broadcast. So you had this kind of a host. You had sometimes interview footage, sometimes scratchy, grainy footage that was supposed to be whatever, Bigfoot or so forth. And in the best cases for me, sometimes they had live recreations of events that were usually pretty lo-fi in their production values. But that in some ways makes them all the more charming, I think. So that to me is kind of what a weird documentary is, even though people are, of course, still making these things for TV and streaming these topics. These were basically, we're out in the movie theater watching them as kids, people probably like you and me.
Absolutely. I kind of feel like the hunger that the Weirdumentary fed is now being fed by podcasts.
Yes, yes. Podcasts, and, you know, and we do have wonderfully, I think, some of these great shows still with Shatner, you know, 50 years after doing first Weirdumentary, you know, some of these for streaming or on TV. Podcasts, it's excellent. Coast to Coast, you know, there's great homes for this.
And every ghost hunting show, I think, it marches in the tradition of the Weirdumentary.
Yes. Yes.
So these things came out. I mean, and they were, look, my generation, I'm 59. I'm guessing you're around there.
54.
Okay.
Later this year. So okay, I'm pushing good. That. You know, so let's keep it. You know, this is where I got to dye the hair back to black. Like, you know, I was a little kid in the 70s, thrilled to this stuff, including sometimes on the front row of the movie theater. You know?
Exactly. I think our generation, the things we loved as a kid took on this sort of totemic. Anytime I see Mad Magazine, and I can't believe it even still exists, but I get that sort of arrow into my soul of that was happening. I mean, the number of people, the hours that I have spent sitting around talking to full-grown adults about Kolchak the Night Stalker.
Oh, goodness. One of my favorite shows, of course.
Right. Yeah. These are the things that sort of stay with us. And then I almost forgot about the Weirdumentary. I almost forgot that I would sit here in Los Angeles watching local TV and the commercials would come on, and it was always like, you always knew what it was. It always had that same flavor, that same smell. Mm-hmm. And for me in LA in the 70s, the phrase held over in Inyo and Kern counties.
Yes.
We literally, I will be muttering that 5 minutes after I die. Yeah. Those were the words that told me. I mean, I don't know what was so special about Inyo and Kern counties and why it had to be held over there.
Right.
But when we're talking about companies like Sun Classic International.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What was their approach to distribution?
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's kind of a, like so many elements of that era, the 70s, you know, their approach has not really lasted much beyond them. It was fascinating what they did. They were based in Utah. They were wonderfully skilled at doing surveys in shopping malls and places to test ideas for potential future audience members. Would you like to see a film about the paranormal? Would you like to see a film about,
the Bermuda Triangle?
Bermuda Triangle. So, you know, they were skilled even at getting the idea going that they felt could be successful. Once the film was made, they did a process. It had been known in the industry, the film industry, since the 1910s, even a little earlier in some cases. What was called four-walling, that would four-wall, like the four walls of a house, or in this case, a movie theater. And so they would send their own people with the print of the film, their own publicity materials, including tie-in materials for things like local bookstores where there would be the book of the film, you know, accompanying it. They would do their own radio ads locally, their own TV ads, and they would rent the theater for a week or two, hence the four-walling. They would bring in everybody. I mean, occasionally they would still hire and pay maybe the local people for concessions or projection, but in general, they kind of rented out the theater. And this is what they would do across the United States, which is why some people will remember these films that are a little younger or a little older, even sometimes we'll think of them at first from a year different than their year of release, because this was a very staggered approach, this four-walling. So I might have seen one, a year after it was in LA, for example, or several months. Obviously, there was a much more staggered distribution, we know, you know, before Jaws and beyond, with, you know, opening on the same weekend. But this had all of the many reasons that had to happen, because they were literally taking prints, you know, in kind of a road show way. What was in the days of Dwayne Esper, you know, known as the road show, where they would literally take the prints, set up, be out of town before anybody could complain too much about a saucy, spicy topic. That was kind of what Sun Classic was doing. But what they found, and I think this was just like a magical formula, they found that they could appeal to the whole family, or even if kids like you and me went alone, my mother, father didn't have any reason to be worried that I, as a 5-year, I would see this, because they were G-rated. Almost all of the documentaries were G-rated. They were intended, Sun Classic's remit really was films for the whole family. You know, in an era where R ratings and new Hollywood films and, you know, films like Alien that I was too young to see in 79, you know, I couldn't go in. They would find these same kinds of topics, you know, aliens and so forth. But they were like for all audiences, you know, general audiences like G suggests.
These were classic matinee movies.
Yes. I mean, a lot of them I saw at Saturday matinees, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, this was 2 p.m, you know, in the summer, and so the first one that I remember seeing was called, and it's still my favorite in a way. It was called The Outer Space Connection.
Oh yes, yeah. And I have a chapter on that one. Yeah,
I was so glad. I was like. I flipped through until, and I'm like, okay, he's got the outer space connection.
Yeah.
Because what I remember about that movie, and again, this is sort of the impact these things had, because the subject matter, this is the only place when you're a 10-year-old kid and you're all about Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster and UFOs and ghosts, this is, you know, this is what you've got before Leonard Nimoy shows up with In Search Of, but that we'll get to that. Yeah. But the outer space connection, at some point in the movie, they said, okay, so, you know, all these researchers and all these, you know, scientists have been gathering information from tombs and from, you know, and then radio pulses from outer space. And they all converge. And for some reason, they're giving us the same date. And that date is December 24th, 2011.
Yes.
Yeah. And my brother and I were like, oh my God. So that's when the aliens are going to arrive. And literally for decades throughout our lives, we would turn to each other and go, when's it going to happen? December 24th, 2011. Through the 90s until that night when we were together on Christmas Eve waiting for something to happen.
Right. Yeah. Santa Claus versus the Martians. Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, and of course we also, you and I remember so well, this was also the period before videotape. So there was no video rentals. There was no, I'll record it and watch it 20 times. You know, it was back when the image, the film, all of them had that special quality that maybe is a little diminished now, where if you didn't see it at the theater, you never knew if you'd even be able to see the film again, or hopefully maybe someday it would show up on TV. So there were a lot of reasons that these films, to me, they like yourself, they have that special place in my memory and my heart.
Absolutely. The rated G aspect of these movies, I think, is huge, because it did allow for, I mean, my parents never went and saw these movies with me. They would drop me off. And what's interesting also is that you mentioned the mall when you were talking about how they would, you know, there'd be focus groups and questionnaires where they would, you know, sort of figure out what people wanted to see. But that again was part of it, was being, you know, going to the mall, my folks dropping my brother and I off at the multiplex, then they would go do their shopping for a couple hours and we would go see one of these movies. And it was, you know, for us, it was super scary, but it also felt kind of grown up, because there were a lot of grown-ups on screen seriously talking about subjects that were typically not taken seriously.
Yes. And that, so many of them had doctor in their name. They had suits on. I joke in the book, I think it's a wonderful part of them. I call it the office of knowledge, where so often they had lots of books behind them, you know, on bookshelves, and it looked like an academic or scholarly library type space. And yeah, they seemed, of course, to us particularly young. I mean, they seemed very trustworthy. And some of those films were, they were fascinating to me, but some of them were scary, mysterious monsters and, you also felt, as we so often do for monsters like Frankenstein's monster, you know, you felt also potentially sympathetic for Bigfoot, because maybe this guy's going to shoot him or, capture him.
Okay. So you're 100% correct. And because of your book, there's a movie that slipped through my fingers. Mm. People have been talking about it well into my adulthood, to the point where I'm like, maybe this was actually something good that I should have watched. Then it was in your book. I literally watched it for the first time in my life about a month ago. Do you know what I'm going to say?
Boggy Creek, maybe?
Yeah, The Legend of Boggy
Legend
Creek.
Of Boggy
That's
Creek,
the one.
Yeah, which is, delightful, because it has not only this kind of recreation dramatized thing, But a lot of handheld camera and some of the things that we would associate with, direct address verite documentary, the later mockumentary world of Blair Witch and so forth, just fabulous.
It was essentially a Bigfoot movie, but it wasn't Bigfoot. It was the
Folk Monster, F-O-U-K-E, down in Arkansas, which is where the filmmaker lived, Charles Pierce. Some of us will remember him, including if only for the reboot, The Town That Dreaded Sundown. That was another of his, not in the weirdumentary category, but more of a slasher movie, So he was a fascinating guy. I wish I had met him, but he was a fascinating guy, fascinating filmmaker. And there are moments in Legend of Boggy Creek that, if you allow yourself to get in the right headspace, they still have a bit of punch, to me.
It's got punch. There are scary moments, but what was so shocking to me and my wife, because I was like, look, I want to watch this. I told Susan, I'm like, I'm not going to drag you along on this journey don't want to, because I have no idea this could be the worst, hour and a half of our lives. And she's like, well, what is this? And it sort of takes place in the South from back in the 70s. She's like, no, we can watch it. And if it's terrible, we'll stop.
Right.
And within minutes, we're fascinated, because it starts out so kind of like elegiac or something, like a reflection on childhood and the magic of this region. Yes. It's very sort of beautiful and poetic.
Yeah, and even the music, some of the music for it may not be the greatest music, but nevertheless, it goes with exactly what you're talking about, because it's not we don't hear at the beginning the typical scary music,
Right.
It's a wonderfully haunting film, and I think, Stephen Bissett, my buddy who did the foreword for the weirdumentary book, that's one of his favorites, too. I mean, I think there are a lot of people who saw it at the time, and it's one of those that stuck with them, ever since.
It really does, because that sort of sentimental tone. I mean, it's not a mixture you see a lot of the scary monster, but also this sort of sentimental, nostalgic.
Yes, yes.
For childhood, for the region. Mm-hmm. And then again, you have got the music. Then you've got moments that feel like it is a documentary, but then you've got the whole sequences, especially toward the end, where it's just sort of playing out like a movie.
Yes. No, it's a mishmash of the best type. And the great thing about it, and certainly a lot of the films I talk about, even some of the really obscure ones, most of them are all quickly, easily free to watch on YouTube. Most of the films I talk about. So it's easy to watch a lot of these very obscure films, thanks, to YouTube and the great users who must be as, whatever crazy as we are, that put them up and love them too.
Oh, that is great news. And that answers a question, because there's so many of them.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, I'm like, well, how did you even see them? But is that how you saw them for the book, through YouTube?
Well, what I did, I wanted to do this book from really my teen years, because I loved these things so much, you know, and I had the soundtrack to Chariots of the Gods and all of it. So I had bought, when VHS started going down in the 90s, a lot of these I bought on VHS because I didn't necessarily think they'd get to DVD. And I'd buy them, you know, when Blockbuster, if people would be clearing, stores would be clearing things out, I'd buy used copies of so many of these, $2, $5, whatever. So that's kind of where I first built the collection. There are always, for better or worse, you know, shall we say, bootleggers in video, you know, selling films on like DVD-R, you know, the recordable DVDs. So I was able to get some through some kind of off the grid bootlegger sellers, you know, and but then, yeah, the gaps, unbelievably, wonderfully, the gaps were filled by YouTube. So to me, this was a long-term project. It was one that I, you know, thought about a long time. You know, I've done a lot of books, but none of them probably gestating for as long as this one.
Yeah, that's interesting, because it is that weird, we're living in the nexus of obsession with childhood, but then as adults, because of the internet, the ability to just sort of go back in time and buy our childhood and have
I mean, thank goodness for everything from YouTube to eBay, buying things we maybe had as kids, or, you know, old Starlog or Famous Monsters or whatever, you know, that I had once and lost along the way and now replace, you know, with thanks to eBay. So it is, I think a lot of it is kind of that strange thing of being stuck in the past, or I don't want to sound too academic. I'm a scholar, allegedly, you know, Dr. Rhodes or whatever, but I don't want to sound too egghead, but it's like that great quote of William Faulkner, you know, that the past is never past, you know, like feel in my head, sometimes I still feel, well, sometimes like I'm 20 or 25, but sometimes I still feel that excitement of when I was 8 or 10, you know, watching Star Wars or these weird documentaries, you know.
You guys, my dream just came true. I get to do a live read ad for a product I actually use and love. I love Indian food. Okay, it's probably after like cheeseburgers, it's my second favorite of all foods. And I love meals that are healthy, fast, and simple to make. So I love the Cumin Club. Let me tell you what this is. These things, they come in packets. You order them. They deliver them right to your home. Here's the beauty. You just add water. You microwave. These things take less than 5 minutes. An Indian entree, ready to eat. It is so delicious. Okay, so let me tell you how I do it. I started off with the paneer tikka masala, which is not overly spicy. And it was perfect for me in terms of spice level. But then I did a second one. I had it with the dal chawal, which is sort of a buttery rice and lentil dish. And I mixed them together. That was my dinner. So the next day I did methi matar malai. You know, I'm sure I'm pronouncing this wrong. My South Asian listeners, you're going to have to tell me how badly I'm mangling this. But anyway, the methi matar malai, it's sort of a sweet, nutty cashew gravy with peas. If you've had Indian food before, I'd say this is like a korma, and it's fantastic. So I did that one with something called pav bhaj. Pav bhaj. It's a spicy veggie stew. Again, not too spicy. You don't need to be afraid. And it was the perfect lunch. Took me 3 minutes. But they've got like 20 more entrees I haven't even tried yet, so I am working my way through. When I'm sitting here writing the podcast, I will suddenly be starving, and that is my danger zone, because that's when I will literally go into the kitchen and grab a bag of Doritos and just eat the whole thing. Don't do that. It's not good for you. It's not good for me. And that's why the Cumin Club is a lifesaver. Like I said, you add water, you put it in the microwave. 5 minutes later, you're eating it. It's a delicious Indian meal you can feel good about. Here's what you do. Click on the link in my show notes, or simply go to thecuminclub.com and put in the offer code RHPB. That's going to get you 30% off. I'll say it again. Go to thecuminclub.com or click on the link in my show notes and enter the offer code RHPB, and you're going to get 30% off. Not on your first order, not in your first two orders. You're going to get 30% off every single time you order. They're going to deliver it right to your door. Eat something good, healthy, and delicious. You deserve it. You're going to feel good about it. The Cumin Club, authentic Indian flavors straight from the source to your door. What am I? I'm going to go have some right now. What am I doing here? Talking about it? I'm going to go eat it. So you talk about, and it gets, you know, into some wonderful detail about the companies and the people who produce these films. And they were largely, it seems, financially successful.
Yes, yes.
Were any of these guys sort of, we're going to make our money on the Weirdumentary so that we can do the thing I really want to do, which is, you know, War and Peace or something like that. Was there, or were they just happy being sort of the traveling?
No, I think a lot of them, certainly some of them, were the former case you mentioned, that it was, I want to do this to make money, to establish myself in the industry and go on to bigger and greater things. In fact, you know, Sun Classic overall wanted to do that, to make bigger budget fiction narrative films. And to an extent, they did do some of that, including for TV. Grizzly Adams was there, if you remember that show.
Oh, my God. So, that is so strange that that's them. I remember that.
Yeah. So, you know, so I think that was true of Sun Classic, but it was true of a lot of the filmmakers that thought, I mean, this was kind of like how I think even some people began, you know, Wes Craven or different people thinking, well, I'll do one horror film because I'll probably be able to sell horror. And then then my Driving Miss Daisy will come later, you know, when I'm successful, or my Citizen Kane. And and then that didn't happen, of course, for most of these filmmakers, you know.
Not that he did Weirdumentaries, but I think Dan Curtis was like that. I think starts out with Dark Shadows and, of course, The Night Stalker, but The Winds of War was kind of his, you know, that was his magnum opus.
That was his pinnacle. And, you know, it's funny because, oh, gosh, we both have known so many people working in film, I suppose. And I have found sometimes, especially years ago when there were more people from the 20s, 30s, 40s living. And I remember one incident, you know, who had made this award-winning documentary, very serious. And I was there talking to him about a 1942 Bela Lugosi monogram film, you know, that was really cheap. He had written it in a weekend. That's all they gave him. He had like 48, 60 hours or so to write it. He couldn't believe, like, I was sitting there at Musso and Frank's, and I'm actually getting him to sign the press sheet for Bowery at Midnight is the name of this film. And he can't understand, come to grips with, why is this guy, and at that time I was living in Ireland and flying to LA, why is this guy wanting to talk about this film I wrote that I'm embarrassed of, basically? And of course, there I'm heralding it as this, you know, wonderful thing, not wanting to talk about, barely knowledgeable of this this award-winning documentary of his, which was much more highbrow in his mind, you know, and thus better, right? Or more worth remembering. Yeah.
Oh, if I had the honor of spending an hour with David Chase, I would never mention The Sopranos once. All we would talk about is Kolchak, The Night Stalker, and The Rockford Files.
Absolutely. Oh, and gosh, Rockford, talk about not only one of the great shows, but also I think one of the three or four best TV theme music, you know, ever. you know, along up there with Sanford and Son and a few others.
Yes.
Those were just like, you want to talk about great music.
Back when television shows had theme songs. Oh my God, yes. Gary.
Oh gosh. Well, and you know, and that's the other, but that's the other thing I think about these Weirdumentaries. I mean, I would joke and say, well, yeah, I've got the soundtrack to some of these, particularly things like Chariots of the Gods, where there was a soundtrack LP, and then it's been reissued on CD in the past 15, 20 years. And one of the things I really came to love rewatching the Weirdumentaries for the book, as well as some of the more obscure ones that I hadn't seen as a child, one of the great things about them is that they pretty consistently, not in every case, but they pretty consistently have great music, great music scores. Yes. Some of it's kind of new agey. Some of it has kind of at times a bit of a funk sound or trying to sound like galactic space funk, you know, or whatever, you know, if you remember that, you know, but
absolutely. But
Yeah, absolutely. So they had great music as well as great hosts and obviously great subjects.
Well, not only that, but I think, and I should have jotted it down like an actual professional interviewer, yeah, but it's Rob Bottin did some of the effects for, yeah, for one of the movies that featured like a Bigfoot family. And I'm like, yeah, of course, like some of these guys,
yeah,
I don't know if Rick Baker ever did, but it wouldn't surprise me.
No, and you know, and unfortunate about some of them is they had limited credits, sometimes people using different names than their own, maybe because of embarrassment, or in some cases, Wheeler Winston Dixon made a few of these. I think they're really sublime. He was an experimental filmmaker, but then he was doing these to maybe make money, get his film company off the ground. He ended up becoming, not unlike myself, a film scholar, a professor at a university, you know, but he did these, but he would write the scripts and produce them. And so his name wouldn't appear so many times. He would give himself pseudonyms, like Sidney Paul was one of them. So,
oh, yeah,
he always worked on these. It's not always possible to know. Sometimes they would misspell people's names on them. You know, sometimes they would have actors that we recognize for other things, pretending to be real people being interviewed about a paranormal subject.
I mean, that's
the craziest one for me, you probably are one of the handful of people on earth that will know who Olin Soll was, the character actor who not only did Batman's voice on the Super Friends stuff of the 70s, the cartoons, but he'd been the choir master on Andy Griffith's show. And, you know, right, he was just, you know, I mean, he had been a spokesperson for a while for the whatever National Prune Organization, and he appeared on their TV commercials way back. Well, somehow Sun Classic got him to sit down. They had a fake CG, you know, lower third name for him. And he's talking as if he's really had a paranormal encounter. And of course, the whole time, it must have even been more true in the 70s, back when people would have recognized him more. You know, the whole time I'm thinking, you know, Don Knotts, Andy Griffith, and you know, in scenes together, you know, in Mayberry. So it's hard always to know who worked on these. Sometimes they gave people fake names. But yeah, some of them had great composers. Some of them had great special effects. Some of them didn't have great special effects, but or makeup, as you're talking about, you know.
It's so strange because it's like for someone to do that. I mean, the Andy Griffith Show was not obscure. People knew what that was.
Absolutely.
To have the chutzpah to just cast an actor from it and have them pretend to be somebody else. But yeah, it begs the question, did, in terms of standards of either authenticity or just, you know, self-regard, were some of these companies or filmmakers more serious, less carnival barker-y than others? Did some really take this subject matter seriously and honestly think, I am contributing to the, you know, the world's knowledge of the Bermuda Triangle?
I think so. I mean, certainly the German who made Chariots of the Gods, which was then had a dubbed voiceover. It was all voiceover. There was no on-screen host in that case. So they easy dubbed to, you know, to English for us to see it. And I think not only did they take it seriously and so many audiences, but I mean, it's hard to believe the following because it's generally forgotten, but Chariots of the Gods was nominated for Best Documentary Film at the Academy Awards for the year in which it made its appearance in America. So those were cases, yes, where you're talking really serious. There are other cases where obviously some of these were more carnival barker or more meant to feed an apparent desire that obviously we prove was there in audience members to see. And then we have people who would do the films but would distance themselves at the same time. When Orson Welles did The Man Who Could See Tomorrow, the Nostradamus documentary, and it was released by Warner Brothers, no less than Warner Brothers, and kind of brought an end to this kind of high-profile era movie theater release, everything. Welles, in his narration, if you go back to that one, he must have insisted on what he clearly says on camera, which is some people don't, in essence, I'm paraphrasing, some people don't believe this, and I'm one of them. I don't believe any of this. He basically says that, and he must have had forced them or asked them, whatever, you know, to let him, like, get his paycheck, do the hosting, but also say, you know, I don't believe any of this. I'm just here to talk about it. So I think it runs the gamut between the very serious, like Chariots of the Gods, to people who, like Wells, who were doing them, but literally saying, I don't believe it. I'm just here to talk. You know?
Yeah, that's really, I didn't know that. And I want to talk about the various hosts, but let's now sort of go back, because I think in the memory of most people, Chariots of the Gods is kind of a beginning or the beginning of kind of speculative pseudo-documentary or pseudo-scientific documentary.
Right.
Now, Eric von Däniken was sincere in his philosophy or in his theories. Is that correct?
I believe so. I mean, we sometimes it's hard to tell even about ourselves certain things. My sense is that, yes, that he was sincere and honest about it, to the extent that, you know, when he did his research and flew around the world to some of these ancient sites that now are so notable to those of us who like this stuff, you know, Easter Island, here, there, everywhere he went, he literally stolen money from the hotel where he worked to fund his trip. He was actually in a jail cell when Chariots of the Gods first came into print in Germany.
Wait, what was he? He was stealing money?
Well, he worked at a hotel. Okay, so he worked at a hotel. He stole money under the table from the hotel to fund his research trips to go all around the world to these, you know, ancient astronaut sites, Peru, Nazca Lines, all of it. And so he was actually sentenced when the book first came out in Europe, Switzerland, Germany. He was actually in jail for, I don't know, I forget, I say it in the book, but maybe a year, year and a half, he got a sentence for theft, you know, robbery, whatever, you know, so embezzlement, I suppose, really. But when you take that into consideration, he could never have predicted that he would have had 60 or more years of a career of one book after another, one lecture after another on this subject. So I think the very fact, in other words, that he was stealing money, knowing he could go to jail, he did go to jail for the sake of a book, the first book. That to me seems like he was probably sincere. Yeah.
Do we know where what scholarship he was following up on? These ideas couldn't have just occurred in his mind out of nowhere.
No. And there were some earlier people that were talking about a various subjects, just like there were earlier films, pseudoscience documentaries. I mean, one of the first ones I mention when I talk about the era before Chariots of the Gods was a film called Is Conan Doyle Right? You know, me, and it was a questioning, you know, spiritualism. Is it real? This is a silent film era short. There were various kind of Robert L. Ripley type short subjects released to movie theaters about some of these subjects, including Nostradamus and so forth in the 1930s and 40s, etc. So yeah, there was a real prehistory here. But von Däniken tapped into the things, I think, also at the right moment, because what to me is really fascinating, maybe it's partially because I'm so interested in Stanley Kubrick and 2001: A Space Odyssey. But that film was released in 1968 at roughly the same time as Chariots of the Gods. Neither von Däniken nor Kubrick would have known about each other's project, nor am I suggesting anything other than the following. Von Däniken's quote nonfiction inquiry is really the same answer that 2001 suggests in a fictional world, meaning ancient astronauts came here, they left these black monolith slabs, and that has helped guide Australopithecines to current humans to the next stage, you know, the star child, the end of 2001. That is all ancient astronauts doing, having visited Earth and, you know, helped us out. And of course, that's what von Däniken was saying. I mean, how could have ancient man moved these heavy stones? You know, you can remember the dialogue, whether in the book or, you know, the film adaptation. And I think it happens at this wonderful moment. You know, look, the summer of love has just passed. The drug era, the new age era, people exploring alternate religions. I mean, it's only 2 years after Anton LaVey founds the Church of Satan in Los Angeles. I mean, in other words, I think that people are at that moment, as well as through the 70s, crystals, all kinds of things, there's this inquiry, this openness to what would have maybe been scoffed at in some earlier eras.
Yeah.
Including from, you know, from certain religious points of view that would have been dismissed or seen as improper to examine. It seemed like that was the right moment for von Däniken and all this stuff, in other words.
Yeah, it feels very Age of Aquarius. And it's very a cross between the wisdom of our elders, the primitive cultures of the past.
Yes.
And yet that new age fascination of self-actualization and what powers do we possess?
Yes. Yes. Including like that. Including Uri Geller and telling us on TV, you can do this at home. Get your own spoon and see if you can make it bend. Yeah. And help, do it with me, and we'll even be this kind of almost like a transcendental meditation or something. We'll, you know, our powers will even be greater by group effort, you know, with him on whatever television show. So I think there's a lot of that. And of course, you know, Bermuda Triangle. I mean, you know, it just goes on and on with wonderful possibilities that as a little kid, I thought, gosh, maybe, you know, there really is telekinesis or maybe there really is a Loch Ness monster or this or that. And so much so that not only did I write this book, but, you know, with my partner turned wife, we got married in May, Kristen. I mean, we went to Loch Ness together intentionally just because basically of the kind of childhood you and I had, you know, and her. She's very indulgent to me, like your wife sounds with Boggy Creek, you know. I think there was that moment though where it felt like, you know, and with inquiry, you know, and there were of course films that by the 80s were making fun of certain things, like Ghostbusters, you know, and they're on campus doing psychic research and then thrown off, et cetera, and they seem a bit, you know, maybe not the most serious scholars in the film. But, you know, in the 70s, it felt like, gosh, there really were people digging into these things. Some of the people we see in these weird documentaries really were fairly legitimate professors that were looking into things like, you know, the corona that might appear around us in Curlian photography.
Okay, you know? Okay. I mean, now we've now hit on two things that I feel like we heard a lot about in the 70s, and we're not hearing a lot about it now. Mm-hmm. One is the Bermuda Triangle. I feel like the Bermuda Triangle was way up there.
Yeah, it's lost a little cachet, I'm afraid.
Right? Yeah, you know, and I know that that there's, you know, you can find scholarship about various things about the Bermuda Triangle now, but Curlian photography.
Mm.
Now, can you, and I don't want to put you on the spot because this is not your area of expertise, but can you tell us what Curlian photography was? Because if we see those images of those sort of almost neon colored against a black background, what was that? What was that supposed to be?
Well, what it was supposed to be, I know from watching these films. What it was, I wouldn't know because I'm a film guy, not a science guy. But on the films, the experts in Curlian photography, which was being done in all kinds of wonderful tests, they were doing photos of people. They were doing photos of individuals. They were doing photos of people together, including doing things like kissing while the Curlian film was running. They were doing things like photos of plants, as well as severing maybe a leaf from a plant and seeing it as still alive, even though it was dead because it had been cut from the plant, right? Like a leaf. So all these different things, the corona or the aura around is what you're describing, what we remember, wild stuff. It's hard to find anybody who still does this, and it seems like it probably deserves further inquiry. I actually, when I was doing this book, I actually was looking like, gosh, I'd like to go have a Curlian photo of myself just because I keep seeing all of this wonderfully strange stuff. The explanations in the film are basically that it's somehow something like an aura that surrounds us.
Yeah.
Like we're giving off a vibe, but more than a vibe, it's almost like it's part of us that's outside of us. It's almost like an angelic halo. It's
right.
Even with and it gets more vibrant, like when two people are kissing because of the emotion, maybe more, you know, whatever, right?
This is getting a little sexy here, Gary. Take it easy.
The weird documentary would border on that, but it only goes so far because of the G rating. But, you know, there was also things like where they would cut off the plant and like, they would have only half a leaf. And somehow, this is what freaks me out the most. If you go back to these films, they'd have only half the leaf, but in the Kirlian, the other half would slowly start to appear as if it could be, well, it was almost like the visual photographic equivalent of somebody with a missing limb that can still feel it, even though it's gone, right?
Yeah.
Photography stuff, it's one of the things that strikes me as most fascinating about the era, as well as among the most forgotten, that kind of needs to have a bit more inquiry, and fame.
It felt like it had to do with auras and by extension, the suggestion of the ghost or the soul of a thing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, because if something's around us, not in our physical being, then that means there is more to us than just our physical being. And here it is photographed in a way that, for me as a viewer, even now, seems a lot more compelling potentially than, you know, a photograph of a ghost, which could be faked, you know, back to Mumbler and, you know, William Mumbler in the 19th century or something.
Well, and it has the patina of science. It's people in white coats in white environments. So right there, the aesthetic is, oh, this is like happening right now on university campuses.
Yes. And some of the people that get interviewed were real university professors. Some of the people on these weird documentaries, there's one, and I forget the exact name. It was so crazy, but it's in the book where a woman is from a university and she's pushing her past life theories, you know, reincarnation and everything.
Sure.
But then I looked up the university and she had started the university, which I don't think ever even had students or other professors. It was accredited, but she actually created the accreditation body. She must have had some cash, you see. And she created the accrediting body that accredited her own university. And so, again, she has the veneer of Professor so-and-so in an office and everything with a university affiliation, but you know, obviously very spurious affiliation, you know.
Well, it's funny because you did have people. I mean, at UCLA, you had Thelma Moss.
Oh yes. And who shows up on some of these documentaries? So you'll maybe find her in the index if anybody's remembering or interested in her. And so yes, some of this. I think it goes back to your question about the filmmakers. Like, were they carnival barkers? Were they hucksters? Were they serious about it? I think that the people being interviewed run the gamut from very not only sincere but like real scientists, real scholars, like you're saying, to the very, very spurious side. So it kind of runs the gamut, just like the filmmakers did, in whether they were believing it. I mean, some of these people are very sincere. You know, Donovan, the singer, of course, was host of one of these weird documentaries, the sincerity of him, I believe, without doubt, you know, and he probably even funded the film he made, you know, and certainly was able to cause it to be made and get released because of his name value at the time. So some of the people, very sincere, some of them, including the professors, very serious, some very not. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was during an era where it felt like, wow, this stuff really is coming into the realm of science.
Breakthrough might be around the next corner. All of a sudden there'll be 1,000 Uri Gellers, or we'll all figure out these things, or we'll meet aliens, like the 2011 date you mentioned, you know.
Totally. It was, when I was a little kid, I thought, oh, well, by the time I'm going to college, there'll be a Department of Parapsychology at almost every university,
that
will be a legitimate area of inquiry. And it feels like technology was sort of getting to a point where it's like, oh, people can, you know, take cameras places, and scientific inventions were going to allow us to have breakthrough. And I look at it like a special period of time in history, because it was for me. But frankly, is it any different than the talk of disclosure that seems to be just unending right now? Everyone, since the time I was a kid, everyone has believed that we're 5 minutes away from knowing.
Yes. No, absolutely. And I think, you know, obviously it undergoes different iterations, including with, you know, all the AI stuff that I don't know if you're like me, but like before our lifetimes, people were talking about AI, both scientists as well as sci-fi. But it seemed like it just, it still seemed like it just like turning on a light switch 2 or 3 years ago, like, oh, now it's here, you know?
Yeah.
It's no longer for labs or for science fiction movies. It's now just flip a switch and it's here, and maybe they'll kill all of us in 5 years or whatever, you know, or what, right? So I think that, yeah, there are those iterations. I mean, I think we see it, you know, subjects that you and I both love, probably, of course, like after the Civil War with spiritualism, after World War I, particularly in England, maybe with spiritualism. So these things happen, but it seemed, I guess for me, and it, maybe it was because I was like yourself, a kid at the time, and you're more willing to maybe believe and, you know, suspend disbelief. But it really seemed like, yeah, it was universities, it was serious people, there were going to be breakthroughs. You know, a lot, I mean, millions of people were buying von Daniken's books, plural, as well as so many others that were being published, and they weren't all little kids like us, you know? So a lot of adults had real serious interests in these things. It really did feel like an era where, yeah, we're on the verge, not just of one discovery, like alien life or something, but so many. Because we are in these documentaries talking about a large array of fascinating topics, aren't we? I mean, from ghosts to Bigfoot to so-and-so, you know?
So in terms of the celebrities that were, that is probably, you know, was the most expensive part of making any of these films was you got to get Rod Serling, you got to get Shatner, you got to get someone with some marquee value. And it's almost surprising the people who turn up. And I'm curious if you got a sense of sort of on a scale who, you know, I guess Orson Welles being the one who believed it the least, but were there people who believed it more, who were proud to have their names associated?
Well, that's a fascinating question. I think that one's hard to tell. If you go back to the couple of Rod Serling ones that were aired on broadcast television, if you go back, to, as I did in the book and quote from some of the reviews, I mean, some of the reviewers were talking about some of the first ones, and I'm talking here about 1971, 72 or so, 73. The reviewers are actually responding to them as if they're very serious documentaries, and Serling's done an excellent job. And so obviously there was the connection with Twilight Zone and so forth, Night Gallery, but you know, he's done it. So I don't know that Serling was embarrassed by them. I don't know, but the reviews would lead one to suspect that some of the viewers at the time who weren't kids like us, at least with the initial phase of them, were seeing them very seriously. So perhaps Serling thought, you know, these are interesting ideas and we're exploring them. That's another thing the weird documentaries often did, maybe sometimes even for legal purposes, was to say, even if they buried it in the credits and text, you know, well, this is just one set of possibilities of many, you know, we're providing questions, we're asking questions, not necessarily giving answers. You know, there were all these kind of legalisms there. Some of them, I don't know. You know, I mean, John Carradine did one of these, Carradine, especially by the 70s, 80s, until his death, was doing about every film he could do. Shatner was doing these. He's done them for so long when he started. You know, it was that period that he himself has talked about, you know, post-Star Trek, more the Devil's Reign period, if you remember that film, you know, when he hadn't had his comeback with Star Trek, the motion picture, and then ongoing to the present day. So he was in kind of that zone where, you know, I wonder, in other words, we know Welles was always looking for money to fund his own projects, et cetera.
Right.
And his lifestyle. I think they did it for the money, probably. I don't know how seriously they took it. I think, I mean, go ahead.
I was going to say, it's like when you find out like celebrities are doing commercials for scotch in Japan.
Yes.
And it's kind of like, well, maybe no one will really count this as part of my career.
Right, right. Well, and it used to be, yeah, I think that was the case. I mean, even some of the old actors in old horror films that I write about a lot, you know, and I talk with some of these actors from the 30s or 40s, even the fellow who wrote the film I mentioned earlier. And I think they thought, you know, oh, I'll do this cheap horror film. And once it leaves theaters, and it'll only play certain theaters because it's low budget, it'll leave in a week or two. And it won't be held over, your earlier phrase.
Hey, well, it'll be held over.
And nobody will ever remember it, not realizing television rebroadcasts, videotape, internet, YouTube, where now if somebody does do a Japanese commercial, we're going to see it on YouTube the next day in America.
Totally.
You know, right?
Yeah.
So hiding is no longer probably possible for any of us. You know, that was another, you know, great thing about that era of the 70s. You know, you could pretend to be other people, you know, I mean.
The brilliant thing you point out is that it's like there have never been as many films in a particular genre whose titles end in a question mark.
Yeah, yeah.
And that question mark forgives so many sins.
Oh, so many sins. The question mark, what if, you know, the word if
right.
appears in a lot of the scripts a lot of times as well. I think that there's a lot of get out of jail free cards there that the films had. But, you know, as a kid, my memory of them, when I saw them as a child, my memory of my reactions, I wasn't focused on the question mark, you know,
No.
I was focused on this really looks like it must be the case. These almost certainly are true, you know.
Okay. So the office of knowledge that you talked about, the office of, in the book, when Gary talks about the office of knowledge, it's when you're photographing a so-called expert and there's a bookshelf behind them, and that's it. I mean, it's kind of perfect.
Right, right. And sometimes a few props on the desk or whatever.
There might be a globe, part of a globe.
A bust of Einstein or something just to make it, you know, more science-y, right?
The trappings of knowledge. It's like, it's so much, it reminds me of like Futurama, but so what they're doing is creating an aesthetic of, not reality, but respectability. In other words, as long as the person is wearing a tie and a short sleeved white shirt with a pocket protector and a protractor and the glasses and they've got that look, then it's okay to ask these questions. And folks, we're just asking questions. Questions. But what you're right, when you're a kid, you're looking at this and it's grown-ups and they've got letters after their name. And you're thinking, well, they wouldn't be talking about it if it wasn't worth talking about.
So
it must be somewhat real.
Yeah, there's gotta be something to this. And sometimes it was even wouldn't have used this phrase in my little kid head, but it was almost for me too, like, well, the numbers can't lie. I mean, look at how many things have gone missing in the Bermuda Triangle. I mean, at what point? I mean, that's just beyond coincidence. I mean, one only gets so lucky at the casino, you know, if you go in, you know, to the roulette table, in this case, bad luck with the Bermuda Triangle. But, you know, I mean, so sometimes it was the numbers. The number of sightings. Sometimes it was the footage we would see of the UFO that would have been shot on Super 8 millimeter film, possibly, that would be scratchy, grainy, footage allegedly of Bigfoot, of course.
Yeah, the Patterson-Gimlin film. Existence of that piece of footage almost led to 15 of those movies.
Oh, yeah. And of course, it comes in the late 60s at that same moment we were talking about earlier with Kubrick 2001, Von Daniken, and all the other stuff we were talking about. So, yeah, I mean, the footage, sometimes the fact it was shaky and murky in exposure and scratched made it seem all the more real rather than if it had been maybe better lit like a Hollywood film, you know?
Right.
I mean, I'm not unlike the kind of, you know, handheld camera that was being seen at that time about, well, everything from the end of the Vietnam War to news each night, you know, what was real, quote, real, and maybe in most cases truly real that we would see on the evening news, you know, with Walter Cronkite or Dan Rather or whatever, would have that shaky camera And those things become the aesthetic, obviously, in the 1960s, 70s, when cameras get smaller and handheld, as well as documentary filmmakers, the Maisels brothers, Pennebaker, all of it. Like this becomes what it's real. If it's shaky and it's murky and it's badly lit, right. it's real.
and it looks like a Martin Scorsese footage film.
You know, that footage and a lot of the others that appears in these films, that footage had the same basic look of oh, we caught a criminal on camera robbing a bank or something, that same shaky, and maybe the criminal was down the road, you could hardly see them. I mean, it had the look of the real, the veneer aesthetically of the real.
And that aesthetic in terms of our modern life was almost established by the Zapruder film.
Oh, absolutely. Because there it is again with, my God, seeing that on television as a little kid, that was a story that also intrigued me, like it did and still grips so many of us, and what was really happening, who really shot him, all of that. And the Zapruder footage is, gosh, I mean, obviously the most famous home movie, I think, in American history, surely, but it had that same kind of look, right?
Because it was that feeling that, well, just a person just standing there with a camera happened to film something that is the most astounding event that has happened in our lifetime.
Right.
And once that exists, and then in short order, the Patterson-Gimlin film, there is this feeling of any one of us walking down the street with a thing that we can hold in our hands could record something that changes history.
Absolutely. And of course, that has come so to fruition, hasn't it, with our mobile phone cameras. Because you don't have to have a 50-foot reel for a Super 8 camera and carry it around all the time.
Except, all the time we talk about on the podcast, that sort of gap in time between the technology of capturing evidence and then the technology of faking that evidence.
Yes, yeah.
And we're now beyond that point. So now, really, it does feel like, well, it's going to have to be more than pictures now.
Yeah, no, I think so. And with AI created images, you know, that's another thing that seems to be moving forward by leaps and bounds all the time. But yeah, I mean, there was something though, seeing that kind of shaky footage and hearing the experts, hearing the voice of somebody like Orson Welles or Shatner or some, you know, authoritative voice even. It all seems so terribly either real or on the cusp. Like next week, somebody's going to find Bigfoot. Maybe 2 weeks. It's got to happen soon.
Well, when I was a kid, we took a trip to Oregon. And all I wanted to do was go to the Bigfoot Information Center in a city called the Dalles. That was all I wanted to do. And everyone else was with the salmon hatcheries and the waterfalls and all that stuff. And yet there came that day when it was like, okay, and my brother and my dad and I went to what was essentially a trailer, and we went inside and saw the plaster casts of the footprints.
Right.
And we talked to this guy. Well, I had no idea who the guy was. British guy. It was Peter Byrne.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And of course, you see him in the trailer in some of the weird documentaries, you know, in the book.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
I had no idea, but it's like he was the guy who was in the place. And he spoke to me and my dad. We were the only people there that day, my brother, my dad, and I, and chatted with us. And I think my dad came away not convinced, but just sort of impressed that it's like, oh, there was a guy there and he didn't seem crazy. And he very rational.
British voice sometimes helps for Americans, you know?
Total. Oh my God. The British guy believes it.
And all this stuff about the depression on the foot. He must have been 200 pounds, this many pounds, or to go this far, and the difference, the links between the strides of the, you know, and a lot of what seemed compelling. You know,
exactly. It felt like, well, this is physics now. We're getting into hard science.
Yeah.
So, and again, that was the charm of these movies, was bringing in these people. Oh my God. And then In Search of Noah's Ark.
I saw that at the movie theater with my family, my mother and father. We all went. And
absolutely.
My dad would refer to it until near the time he passed away. He'd also regularly mention Von Daniken's name in jest. Remembering all of that era, But even for my parents, you know, Mount Ararat and these people who had climbed it and, well, we can't get there because of the government is not allowing it, you know, but we have this evidence and somebody flew over and thought they saw. I mean, again, you know, I think, yeah, some of this was quite compelling at the time. And I think maybe we were, maybe even adults, a little bit less jaded, a little bit more naive possibly than now. In some ways, I think that was a great thing because there was more, it was maybe more open to new things, you know, and so forth. But yeah, In Search of Noah's Ark was another of these that I cover. And of course, that gets into kind of the more speculative history that some of them covered, you know.
Yeah. And that was, because that was 78, I think. And that was kind of, you know, prime time.
Oh, yeah.
And then, of course, when Leonard Nimoy and In Search Of was ruling the airwaves, I talk about it with friends of mine, younger people.
Yes.
Who, for them, you know, for me, for you, it was In Search Of. For them, It's Unsolved Mysteries.
Right. Yeah, sure.
Which is a weird eumentary of its own, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it is. It is. But yeah, In Search Of, and then subsequently, I think the Arthur C. Clarke shows, you know, that he did, like Mysterious World, those did bring it like weekly into the home, covering these same subjects, even more, you know, the death of Marilyn Monroe or whatever the other, the range of topics Nimoy could cover were even greater, of course, because the show was on for several years and so many episodes. And it did bring it home, and it was a wonderful thing. But I do think, yeah, it started changing. I think and I misstated earlier, I caught myself thinking as soon as after I said the title, it's The Man Who Saw Tomorrow is the exact title of the Wells Nostradamus film. And it Warner Brothers distributed it. And, of course, the other thing to say is most of what we're talking about was shot on film, not videotape, the entire documentaries, weird documentaries. You know, after that comes, of course, VHS, and home video, the cable explosion, and, you know, Discovery Channel, and some of these shows like Ancient Astronauts, Unsolved Mysteries, and all everything. But for me, maybe it's being too much interested in film, but I think the fact that these were shot on film, as well as so regularly, and In Search Of was, too, of course, even though it was broadcast on TV, that was even another layer of, if not prestige or authenticity, truly, it just... You know, it was not like, well, maybe I'm being a bit of a snob in terms of film aesthetics here, but, you know, but not just because I liked the look of film better, but it just seemed maybe that obviously more money involved in many cases, et cetera, different than an Ancient Astronaut show every week on cable show that's being rerun and five times in the middle of the night or what have you, you know?
Well, there is, you know, you sort of hit on it, you know, we get to the television show In Search Of, and it gets renewed season after season. And at a certain point, they're like, what do we do next week? Should we go back to ghosts, haunted castles, maybe?
And then, of course, it becomes sometimes things like the Lindbergh kidnapping, or there's a handful of those. Again, it's speculative history and, you know, I mean, things that happened, but, you know, different, theories for how and why they happened, or conspiracy theories, you know.
Now, I did get the feeling that Leonard Nimoy was interested in these things and thought they were worth talking about. I never got the feeling that he was just showing up, cashing a paycheck, and moving on.
No, I agree with you. And so that goes back to that question you asked, which is a fascinating one. Well, you know, how sincere were the hosts, the filmmakers? How much did they believe, not believe? I mean, it's hard to know always, of course, but I truly thought the same thing with Nimoy, including going back through the entirety of the show's run for the book, In Search Of, that series. He seemed very sincere, very engaged, interested, and talking in a clinical, in a very well presented, of course, because it was Nimoy, but also in a kind of, I say this compliment, in kind of a clinical term. In other words, not being dismissive with a tone of voice or some of the things that Wells, I think, would also did. Because along with Wells distancing himself explicitly from Nostradamus, he would occasionally have a tone of voice that would have a hint of skepticism in it or whatever, where Nimoy seemed to be the totally objective, unbiased, and of course, great presenter, you know.
Okay, now I've heard so much about the Arthur C. Clarke show and had never, certainly didn't see it when it came out, and I've only seen a couple of clips on YouTube. Was there a difference in terms of the point of view of the show itself and how it approached these subjects? The sense that I get, and this may be completely wrong, is that Arthur C. Clarke was a little more skeptical, but I don't know. Yes. What do you think?
I believe that. On the one hand, you get Clarke, and as the opening narration of the show told us, you know, inventor of the communications satellite and, you know, author, scientist, you know, now living in Sri Lanka, where he devotes his time to scientific pursuits or whatever the exact narration says, you know, he seemed, on the one hand, there is that veracity, verisimilitude. Boy, this is a trustworthy guy. On the other hand, you're right. He sometimes seems skeptical. He does things, though, that in the first iteration of his show, because it went through more than one and more than one title, but in the first one, the final episode is he actually calculates his belief in the likelihood of the different subjects he's covered.
Oh, wow.
And that seemed, in its way, he definitely, yes, seems more skeptical. But stuff like that to me as a kid, and by then I would have been more like 10, 11, 12, and a little older, but to me that seemed like, wow, he's not dismissing all of it, you know.
Yeah.
He's looking at the evidence and coming up with these, maybe I believe in UFOs more than I believe in the Loch Ness Monster, and I believe maybe in Bigfoot more than Loch Ness Monster because the Bigfoot has more terrain than you know, well, you know, like he's going through a logical process and does not entirely dismiss the stuff he covers, but most of it certainly. So you're right. He's more skeptical, but in some ways it may be also because I was more 10, 12 years old at the time. It seemed like, wow, here's somebody who's really almost mathematically calculating the likelihoods of these phenomena.
And I think those shows, because they were kind of the only thing of their kind, had to throw a wider net philosophically so that everyone could be invited to the party. Whereas nowadays you do have shows that feel they're either very much about every house we go to is haunted, or on the other hand, it's Mythbusters and Penn and Teller bullshit, you know?
Yeah.
And it's okay. So everyone now just has their own room they go to, which I guess is kind of the way media is in general.
Well, I guess so. But, you know, another thing that disappoints me about the modern series of the weird documentary type is, you know, I mean, I'm so grateful. Everybody loves Shatner. I love Shatner wildly, you know, everything. I'm so glad he's doing the show still. But the thing about, like, his show and the other comparable shows right now has nothing to do with him. But they'll have the interviews will be with the same six or eight people on every episode, you know, like they're just hired like actors. So they're not going necessarily to the most famous Bigfoot scholar or what have you. They've just got six or eight, 10, 12 talking heads, some of them university types, again, building on the tradition. But you know, of course, each episode may cover a few subjects over episode after episode, many subjects. Well, there's no way this person is studying as a PhD'd accredited professor all of these hundreds of things maybe that get covered in over several seasons.
Yes.
So they're reading something off Wikipedia. I mean, I don't know exactly what they're reading, but I mean, you know, it almost seems like, well, are they just staring at Wikipedia for 5 minutes before, okay, let's get you five sound bites on the Loch Ness Monster, even though you've really not studied it? Because it's cheaper. It's much cheaper to get you down and film a whole season's worth of interviews once, including about all kinds of things that are not your area of specialism, you know.
Well, I know that the era of the classic weirdumentary has passed and isn't likely to come back, but it is so gratifying to me to think about myself as a little kid being so fascinated with this stuff, and you too, and how that desire to speculate on those subjects and to talk about them late into the night, like we said, is still being fed with cable shows and podcasts. Yes. And, you know, and the joke is we still don't have the answer. We still know Bigfoot's still out there.
No, exactly. And the question continues, right? Maybe. What if possibly this exists? Maybe we'll know someday, question mark, you know. And that, of course, is part of the joy of this, you know, kind of topic.
And Gary, your book is filled with such affection and such great humor. And thanks. It is so beautiful. And this is a beautifully produced book. I don't even know how you get a book to be produced at a price that looks like a museum piece. Every page
well,
is
thank
gorgeous.
You for that. You know, that there, I've got to say, you're so nice to ask me questions and mention the book and everything. But if I can, I'll just say, you know, Feral House is the publisher. They're an amazing press. It's funny because the first time I ever worked on a film book, it was a Feral House book when I was about 14 or so. I was a research assistant on the Rudolph Gray biography of Ed Wood that became the Tim Burton movie. And that was kind of how my film history publication started. And then so many years later, 40 or so, I'm back with Feral House this time. And they did this most beautiful cover. They did this incredible layout. They allowed color photos, tons of them in the book, and beautiful page quality, so much color. They were tremendous, and they're a tremendous press. They put out all of these cool books, including on subjects you and I both love, so I'm really grateful because they got it. They understood the book in a way that we do this subject. And that some publishers I went to, you know, normally I've been lucky that I including with my first book of my own, which was on Bela Lugosi in the 1990s. I was in my 20s and, you know, the first publisher I went to, they had snapped it up and I was very fortunate, you know. This book was the hardest book of any to find a publisher because they either thought, you know, well, this is just a documentary book or what's the big deal with these films? They still make them. You know, they didn't get it. You know what I mean? Like sometimes pitching a film idea or a book topic to a public, you know, sometimes people immediately are on the same wavelength. Sometimes they're a million miles away. And so this was the hardest book I ever had out of now probably, I don't know how many books I've done, some of which I've edited, but like 30, 40 books or more. This was the hardest one to find a publisher. But once I did, they were like, sometimes like you go out on 30 dates and then you meet the woman of your dreams that becomes your wife, right? And you're glad to have slogged through to find the absolute perfect love of your life. Well, that was Feral House in this case as a publisher because they got it, they understood it, and they treated it like, you know, now it would be hard to get many film books unless it's somebody really super popular of today's world, like, you know, Tarantino or something. It'd be hard, or you're working with Toshin, you know, a press of that caliber.
Sure.
I mean, short of that, you know, you just don't, you know, you can't get publishers to take on more obscure topics and do them with the kind of not only their affection for the topic, but the money clearly for color photos and stuff. That is harder and harder in today's world. Very hard. And so I'm very blessed that I was very fortunate, you know, to be with Feral House because they're super cool and they do super cool stuff.
They really do. And I was so happy to learn about their existence through your book. Literally everything down to the font, it's just perfect.
Because they're mimicking some of the font styles of that period. The graphic designer was unbelievable. And, you know, it's like you generally don't want to bother graphic designers when it's a really very graphic type book with so many photos and everything. But I had to say to them, like more than once, to the editor, Christina Ward, please tell him I just think this stuff's tremendous. As I was getting, you know, sections of the book in phases as PDFs, I was just like my mouth agape that wow, this is so beautiful. And it's not a book. Look, I love Citizen Kane, et cetera, but it's not a book about Citizen Kane something that prestigious. It's not a book about somebody as famous as Marilyn Monroe. So for them to have done this for the subject we're talking about today, it's unbelievable. So I'm really, really grateful.
It's like a coffee table book. It's the kind of book you want to sort of leave out for guests in your home to like pick up and start looking.
you're making my day.
Well, it is. It's the kind of book. And again, you don't have to read it front to back. You can open to any page. And within a paragraph, you're into it. You know, just very short chapters.
I'm so glad you say that because I wanted to do it in that way where, you know, if there's certain films you're not interested in or you're like In Search of Noah's Ark and you're really just interested in the alien or ghosts, you know, you could pop in and out of the book. I wanted it to be informative, but also humorous, but in a good natured kind of humor, because I do love these.
It is.
And my and so most of the time, some of the time, certainly my books are very, you know, PhD guy writing a book, very serious about whatever old movie. Here I did want to have fun and writing it like in a fun style with a little humor, because I love these films and it seemed like the best way to approach them.
It's the perfect voice. It's exactly right. It's the affection of having grown up with them. It's never talking down about them, you know.
Yeah.
And so often your entries end with a salute to your favorite part, a line,
yes,
of narration,
yes,
a narrator's affect, the recreations. You're sort of like, I'm so glad they took the time to actually do, you know, some Bigfoot makeup. It makes the movie.
Yes, no, I appreciate all of that, because that was my hope for the book. And I do love them and have a kind of respect for them and their makers. But my close buddy, he's right, film writer of some note, film historian, Tom Weaver. You know, we're one of my best friends. Anyway, I was groping for a title, you see, for the book, for this new word, right?
Yeah.
And one friend of mine suggested, Robert Guffey, who's a great novelist, and Cryptoschatology was one of his famous books. Anyway, he suggested Fortumentary, after Charles Fort. And
Charles,
I thought, well,
Fort,
that's perfect,
sure,
but not as many people will know Fort's name, possibly, even with the Fortean Times, you know, magazine still going. My friend Tom Weaver, I kept laughing about this. I still want to laugh each time I think of his suggestion, was Crocumentary, because the films are croc, you know. But as hilarious as that was, I talk about this in the introduction, in my introduction to the book, I couldn't finally go with, that was like so great because it rhymes so perfectly with documentary, but I thought it was a little bit of a nastier type of humor, you know, like a kick you when you're down kind of humor of these films. So I wanted to stay with humor, but
yeah,
like, hopefully laughing with them, not at them.
We're not in Mystery Science Theater 3000.
No, none of that kind of humor at all, I don't think.
No, it's more,
certainly not overall. You know, I'm trying to, you know, enjoy the films as I am now, rather than the total fascination and adherence I would have had at the age of six. You know,
it's the perfect mixture, and it sort of has a foot in both worlds. I can't
appreciate it really deeply.
Just enjoyed it so much. I recommend everyone go out and get it on anywhere you can. Go straight to Feral House. You can get it right there, can't you?
Absolutely. They can go direct to Feral House. And gosh, we need all of the great listeners you have.
Okay.
A show about a bookshelf. We need to support the smaller presses, the independent publishers, more than ever.
Yeah.
But I also know the temptation to click so quickly on Amazon. And so you get it there too, et cetera. But
I
appreciate it very much. Yeah.
It's always so hard on this show. Any link, if I possibly can, is either directly to an author's website or a publisher or bookshop.org, which is the great alternative for book buying online.
Yes. Yes.
Sometimes they're just, I want to support a book and there is no other way, but I think with yours, we can go other places and really support Feral House, which I love the fact that they fell in love with your project in the right way.
They did. And it seems like, even though I couldn't get those first publishers interested or to understand it, now that the book's out, I keep meeting wonderful people like you who understand it. Like, the audience was there, even if some publishers didn't get it. I did the first real talk I did when the book was published was at the Los Angeles Breakfast Club in May.
Okay.
And
last May, because this book just came out in the last year.
Yeah, yeah. And that was even before it was available on Amazon or whatever, like advanced copies. And I was there at the Los Angeles Breakfast Club. And I don't know, 300, 500 people or whatever, you know, in attendance. And they were just in love. I showed clips and everything. And this isn't as much about, I'm not trying to talk about me or the book, but they were also in love with the topic, you know. So the audience, certainly of people of a certain age, you know, the audience is there. And Feral House thankfully believed that. You know,
so And now I want to ask, is there anything you've got coming up that we should know about or get ready for in the next year or something? What's next?
Well, I just sent the final manuscript for my next single-authored book. It's a little bit more of a serious subject on the history of the scalping trope in North American culture, from poetry, novels, Fenimore Cooper, through recent horror films, like the use of that trope and how it's been used. Including, as I'm myself Native American, I'm Cherokee, and how it's been used against Native Americans, particularly in terms of Western expansion and so forth. The more fun project that I'm working on right now, like in the trenches.
More fun than scalping.
More fun than scalping. Lots more. Lots more, right? you'll really lose your head over the next one. See, this is the bad humor coming out, the bad humor, man. I'm doing a book. I have made some really huge discoveries. I cannot believe it at this late date in history about Bram Stoker's Dracula, his inspirations for it, including volumes that I have found, even his own handwriting, marking passages, books that we didn't even know he had used. And some of them with, I'll tell you, this one is coming. It's coming out as an article first and then a book. One of them was a Hungarian novel published in England in English. He was a very popular Hungarian writer, so much so that the Queen of England actually was a big fan of his. The one book that I found that all of Stoker's markings was about Transylvania. It has a section on Dracula and the word and the name. And its title, Stoker even repurposes in his novel the title of this in English. The English language version was called Midst the Wild Carpathians. And that is, he actually takes that phrase for Harker's Diary. If you and your listeners are, I'm sure some are Dracula fans.
Oh, so, absolutely.
Because vampires are where I spend a lot of my time. In fact, if you'll allow me one last indulgence, you're too nice. My book that came out right before Weirdumentary, a little bit more serious in tone, but it's out in paperback just very recently, cheap paperback for today's world, cheap. And it's called Vampires in Silent Cinema. And
oh my God.
With the recent, Robert Eggers did the blurb for my book because of the Nosferatu connection with the recent versions, which may make the subject a little bit more of interest to, you know, your listeners, and some people, and Elias Mirisch, my dear friend, wrote the foreword. He had made the film, directed the film Shadow of the Vampire with Willem Dafoe and
oh my God, that's a great movie.
That's about the making, of course, the fantastical alternate speculative history about the making of Nosferatu. Eli directed that film. He also directed one of my favorite films ever, which was Begotten from the 1990s, an avant-garde film. But at any rate, so if your audience likes vampires, they're the book before Weirdumentary was Silent Vampires, and they're the next book about Stoker.
You are now part of our family here at Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf.
I told you yourself, I think, in an email, but just to further hopefully concretize my credos here, my credentials, as part of our honeymoon, I took my beautiful, lovely new wife to Point Pleasant, West Virginia, to, of course, the museum and so forth.
Who needs Paris?
Who needs Paris? We got married in L.A. at a movie theater. My best man was Bela Lugosi Jr.'s son-in-law. The woman who read the poem I wrote for my wife, was Candace Hilligas from the star of Carnival of Souls. Some of your listeners will remember that cult movie from 1960. You know, and a bunch of other film people there. I'll shut up now about it. But and then we took off for the Day of the Dead convention for the Night of the Living Dead films in Pittsburgh, and then on to Point Pleasant. So that's the kind of beautiful woman I married, inside and out.
Exactly. You found a keeper, and literally, there's nothing more romantic than this stuff. Come on.
No, well, when you have the same interests, right? And that's where I'm so glad when you say I'm part of the family here, because we share, and I know I do with your listeners, so many of these great, great subjects, you know, that we never get tired of, I think.
Gary, this has been so great. Thank you so much for coming on. Will you come back when the next book, when the Bram Stoker book comes out?
That would be my question to you. I was about to say, please bring me back, please. Right? What if I could only come back? I'm doing back to the what ifs.
You're coming
back. I can't
wait.
Thank you so much. I deeply appreciate it. Thank you so very kindly.
Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producers are Tess Feifel, Sailor Franklin, and Harrison Marks. Our sound designer, editor, and engineer is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver. Our website is by Kayla Lord. And our music, as always, is by Nima Kazzaruni. Until next time, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.